Our next reader is Sue Elsley. Sue teaches at McGill and at Dawson College. Sarah teaches at John Abbott. Anyway, this is Sue Elsley's first book, and it will be Sarah's first book as well, I, Nadja, and Other Poems by Sue Elsley. And it will be coming out in August 2006.
I'd likewise like to thank Zeke for the space and everybody for coming out to hear the reading. This first poem is called Convalescent. I became fascinated with the genre of convalescence. It didn't help when I went to Banff, and it's sort of like a mountain retreat. And did a lot of thinking about it as well, as my sister was sick. And so here's Convalescent. I think if I am dying, then I will want to go to the beach. Someone will prop me up on a chaise longue. I even like hearing the words chaise longue. Under a canvas umbrella, snapping like rigging in the wind. Facing the ocean, of course. I'll drink Evian, liquid yoga, my friend calls it, from a glass with a bendy straw. I see a hand, not my own, supporting that glass, and another adjusting the pillow behind my head. Then my friend begins to slice me an Alabama peach. What does this mean, I worry? I'm sure it's neurotic to devour convalescence as a genre. It's not so bad, my friend tells me. It means you are always getting better. It means you are already past the worst. And I'd like to read a few poems from the Nadja section of my book. These poems are inspired by the relationship between André Breton and his surrealist muse, Nadja, who gave herself that name because in Russian it's the beginning of the word hope, and it's only the beginning. And I became fascinated with this story when I took a course when I was at the University of Nice. The course was called Première Rencontre, and it was all about first meetings in literature. And this is Première Rencontre, the first meeting from Nadja's point of view to counterbalance the one from Breton's. Première Rencontre. I was crossing the Place Franz Liszt when, through an open window above the florist shop, I heard someone playing Chopin and smiled at the irony. I stopped because I had something stuck to my shoe. He turned as I was about to pass, and he held out his hands like someone asking directions or the sales girl's advice on which scarf to select. Was I supposed to swoon? In one of his hands, a book wrapped in paper, which I felt he wanted to unwrap for me. In the other, a question he needed me to puzzle through. We stood aside for someone to pass, and in that instant of moving closer to him, so as not to brush up against someone else, I knew that I could forget myself. I had a hair appointment, it's true, just not that afternoon. His hand was warm. We walked to a cafe and sat facing the entrance to the metro. He will go home to his wife soon, no matter, I thought, although he hadn't said yet. The way he glanced at his watch, it was that. Still, he was talking, and I began to feel the good chill one feels after swimming all day with evening coming on and autumn. I was talking rapidly. For a few moments, it was as if there were heavy curtains around us, the world muffled. I looked at his face for the first time then. When I picked up my glass, I had to use two hands. I flicked my cigarette, the whole ember split off. He was looking at my nails, and then so did I. What did I hope to happen? He reminded me of that young man I loved in Lille. But even a glove on the street can make you reach for it, thinking it's your own. And this one's called We Took the Train, about their probably only romantic encounter when they took the train out to a suburb. We took the train on impulse to Saint-Germain-en-Laye, arriving very late beside the chateau, two blurred forms by the curlicued railing, momentarily transfixed by the shuddering lights of the city, the black box of the sky, the sleeping valley we'd cross to try to outrun this storm. Even the gravel under my feet was singular, and later, in the frayed light of our room, his low, monotonous, sleepy voice, his earlobe between my teeth, my lips pressed kisses, my nose gently grazed, collarbone, knobs of the locked armoire of his heart, the bee buzzing in the nest of his throat, the soft, deliberate way he said, "I'm going to come now, I'm coming now, now." No more words then, his throat a flower closing in the dark. And this is from the point of view of one of Breton's comrades in the surrealist circle. "Button up your overcoat." These were Nadja's only visitors. "Button up your overcoat. More beauty than you or I could bear. Yesterday, Louis and I rode the train down to Épinay-sur-Orge to see how she is faring, your Nadja. Clouds hum black and low over the hospital, very theatrical. We chose not to read this as a sign. We missed the worst of it. The rain came down in sheets once we were inside, scraping some chairs together. A nurse brought Nadja a pill to take. She made a weak joke about invisible friends. Indeed, we all did our best to keep it light. Didn't ask about you. The acuity of her loss, though, I knew a cleaner version of it after Gala left me for the mustache and everyone took me for dead. Granted, I see why you consider it best to button up your overcoat and keep dark as far as she is concerned. The Sphinx is thin and cage-chafed as the lions in the menagerie. Frankly, she's not going anywhere soon. You thought she was delicate before. Her nerves are shot, shot. Smoking one of my cigarettes, she looked like a mouse drinking from a spout." In a completely different mode, this is called Accessories After the Fact. I'm fascinated by material objects and the life of things, and so I'm playing with what things do in their off time. Accessories After the Fact. Prudish chaperone of décolletage, scarf muffles a multitude of sins, hides a hickey, stray nips and tucks, scratch marks that gloss the lady killer's lost hours. Belt is used to wallop the children and to hold up Papa's pants. Grants the prisoner a quick escape, finds loopholes. Bag, what are you hiding in there? If they could only find the bag of bloody clothes. Gloves, need I see more? Keep it under your hat. Glance at watch too much and it gets itchy. Time's wheelman puts the pedal to the metal and you're hung out to dry. Builds your trust and then clocks you. The rendezvous missed, the life, tick, tick, tick of your own scapegoat heart. Dark shades cover a shiner, cliché the cop in his mirrored teardrops. Shoes will carry you from one misdeed to another. You wear them out, dragging them along on sordid errands, in the summer wet with dew, in the winter stinging with salt. When you take them off, they cringe. This poem, Dainty, it really started when I let myself play with a word that momentarily sounded funny in my mouth and in my ears, and so dainty, I just went with it. I'm tired of apologies. If you say anything this time, make it a word you can pick up with a toothpick. Embroider on the shoulder of a Givenchy gown, a word like acupuncture for sadness. Pearls concentrate light, small, cultivated. Or a Lalique butterfly, something with filigree. in a box no bigger than a lozenge. A fracture is eased by the balm of dainty, applied to the wrist like a tennis bracelet. In the supermarket, I can buy dainty rice, wearing sunglasses, a potassoir wrap, elbow-length gloves, my going-away outfit, kept very far from the rat poison and lie. I'm tired of apologies. Give me the lanula of my fingernails after a manicure, something I can slip into painlessly, like vintage silk, and dainty, dainty, even the dungeon walls will perspire. And the last poem is called First Apology to My Daughter. I birthed you like an animal, soft flanks rising with calm, deepening breaths, brown eyes indifferent to the hands of well-meaning helpers. After hours of baffled pushing and an enfilade of sutures, I surrendered you to the nursery just a couple of hours while my body sunk into the mattress like a slug sinks back into the earth after its encounter with a shovel. I didn't know the harried nurse would think it best not to wake me to feed you. You yearning for your first milk while I dozed on some far-off platform. That you would tighten the coil of your body, trying to burst the seam of your swaddling blanket and cry, that tremulous muscular cry, and me out of earshot. Cry long enough to give up on crying. What darkness then, in the fluorescent hours of the maternity ward, while I taught you the ferocity of hunger.